On this episode of Interview in Indies, we talked to Chris Barassa, the co-founder of Red Hook Studios, and we discussed Darkest Dungeon, Darkest Dungeon 2, and the recent acquisition of his studio from Behavior. If you want to support the episodes and get them a few days early, be sure to subscribe on Patreon, and of course, enjoy the show. Hello, welcome to Interview in Indies episode 6. Today I'm joined by Chris Barassa, who I last name I probably said wrong, who's the co-founder of Red Hook Studio.
You got it.
Oh, I got it. Thanks for taking some time to join me, Chris. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks.
So we can just start out. I like going into the history of everybody, so I would love to hear the history on how you got into game design and art, because I'm not sure if you're into coding and all that, but how did you get into the industry, really?
Well, it was a long time ago. I went to an animation school in Burnaby, which is a city adjacent to Vancouver in Canada, and did a two-year diploma there for digital animation, which I hated. I hated animation so much, but I loved doing like character sheets and painting textures and that kind of thing. And obviously I'd always drawn stuff. And so I made a 2D game kind of on my own just for fun. I got my roommate to help me with a sequel. And eventually use that as kind of a portfolio piece to join up with a very, very small little company out in the boonies. And we pitched that to Ubisoft and actually worked on a version of that game for about a year and a half before it got canceled. But then I had, you know, some portfolio pieces and I had some industry know-how, and I applied to a company called Digital Eclipse, which then turned into Backbone, and I spent 3.5-4 years there, just kind of working my way up from like art lead to ultimately studio art director, which felt insane to me because I was pretty young and I felt like I had a lot to learn. So the position felt at odds with my industry experience. So I left that job to go be a concept artist at Propaganda Games, which was a Disney-owned studio, and worked on the Pirates of the Caribbean third-person RPG that got canceled. So I have a long and rich history of canceled games. And then I just freelanced for quite a while. I did a year art directing a cartoon show. And then, you know, I had met Tyler, you know, at Backbone / Digital Eclipse. And, you know, we just kind of talked a lot about wanting to do something together at some point. And finally, the timing lined up. So we started Red Hook in 2013.
So you say you have a lot of canceled games. IMDb, I checked up your IMDb because you're famous enough to have one. They only gave you credit in two games with Bomberman Live and Sonic Rivals.
You know what's crazy is that I didn't touch Bomberman Live at all.
You didn't even touch it at all and you're still credited in it.
And I did other stuff that I'm not getting credit for. That was Bomberman. I don't know how I got on the credits for that because it's on my Mobi games too, apparently. I don't look at any of these things. I don't know what anyone's saying about me. But yeah, it's listed there too, apparently. And I had nothing to do with it. I was at the studio at the same time that it was made.
So they just threw your name in. They were like, oh, these here.
I guess. I don't know. I think maybe because I think I was like studio AD at that point. And so maybe like all studio level employees automatically get a credit on every game that gets made. I'm not sure. But I don't deserve any recognition whatsoever for Bomberman Live.
But you do deserve that recognition for Sonic Rivals.
Hell yeah, I do.
Okay. Is there any smaller projects that like you take a lot of pride in that you're like really proud of that a lot of people may have never even heard of?
I worked for about 8 months at a Microsoft studio on a game that was going to be pretty neat. That got canceled too. So it's a lot of stuff people haven't heard of. When I was interviewed for one of my first jobs, someone asked, you know, okay, you're applying for like a concept artist or like an art lead position. What happens if we just need you to design a health bar? Are you going to be unhappy, you know, kind of doing that? Because it's, you know, the implication was, is this work going to be beneath you? And I was like, that sounds great. I'll do the best health bar I can. So I think there's a lot of people who work in the industry who aren't known for anything, but who do really great, passionate work, even on the kind of more mundane aspects of games or things you take for granted when you play them.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of games. What was that other one called? Mobi Games. Your Mobi Games had a lot more credited work to you compared to IMDb. But
no. No idea what they say about me here. Let me see.
I think there was like 14 games on there.
Really?
I don't even know if Bomberman was on there, though. But they definitely have a lot more than IMDb did.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these are special thanks because I backed a lot of games on Kickstarter for a while. Yeah, Company of Heroes, special thanks. Yeah, I don't know.
Your name is in the credits of a lot of work.
Sure.
So you I'll take it. You and Tyler met at Backbone and then formed Red Hook Studio. What was that process like forming a studio for aspiring indie devs? Because obviously you guys have, I guess you could say, made it.
Well, I'll tell you what it looks like. It looks like two guys sitting in a bedroom, one at a desk and the other on a chair, maybe 12 square feet, trying to figure out how to get something made. When you start a studio, at least in my experience with the studio I started, it was very humble. It was just the two of us sitting around going, how do we do this? We're serious about it. We're committed to it. But at this moment, the company's assets consist of our time and whatever money that we happen to have saved over the past however many years. So starting a studio maybe sounds more auspicious than it actually feels. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's very humbling to be like, okay, well, I don't have a job. I guess we've started a studio, you know?
And then one day you have a job because it flourishes now.
Yeah. It's crazy. This is the longest I've ever been employed in the games industry, is at the company that I started. So I kind of like that.
Now, obviously, the studio flourished. Darkest Dungeon did great. Darkest Dungeon 2, I'm sure, also did great. And recently, you had the acquisition with Behavior. I want to ask, is that acquisition, was that the most negative feedback you've received in any of your work with the community?
Oh, no. When we added like corpses to DD1, you know, we were getting death threats and all of the game pundits were screaming that we had ruined, you know, what was once a promising early access title with this one update. And that was really, really hard. Because it was also our first time facing backlash, so it was kind of an unfamiliar feeling, which, you know, I understand how privileged that sounds. But we had, you know, released Darkest Dungeon to great critical and commercial success into early access. We had done several updates, and each time it was just like home run with the community. And so that was the first time where we're like, holy cow, like these people are not happy with us. And it was tough to watch kind of the inversion, or at least some of the more news adjacent personalities in the industry kind of jump at the opportunity to create a narrative where it was like the story of Darkest Dungeon was a game that was going in the right direction and was somehow, you know, ruined. So we were really worried about that, and it was a hard time, but we navigated that and got through it. And you know, I expected the acquisition to be met with similar kind of negative reactions. I think we did a Q&A last week, and one of the things I said, and I feel like it bears repeating, is that negative doom posting about, you know, an outcome that hasn't happened yet, but that you're afraid of, it is really an expression of fear and love for the thing, right? Like you love something so much and you're afraid it's going to change or go away or be ruined or be compromised. And I understand that. So I think for that reason, it sounds maybe a little cheesy, but I kind of harvested more of a positive feeling from the negative comments this time out, because I understand what people are worried about. I get it. I'm not like, I've been in this industry for quite a while at this point. I've seen a lot of like mergers, acquisitions go bad. We're not blind to that being a reality for a lot of studios. And I've seen some of my favorite studios get acquired and be destroyed too. I was a big Warhammer online player back in the day, and EA bought Mythic and then slowly kind of just ground it down, and that game is gone now. So I understand it, and I was kind of ready for it. You know, I think that's the first reaction online is a lot of kind of hyperbolic doomsaying as people sort of react emotionally and immediately. No one's going to react immediately positively to news like that. But we just feel like, you know, there's a lot of reasons we can unpack why we wanted to do it. But at the end of the day, we just feel strongly that we have to just keep showing up for work, keep making the content, authoring it the same way, having the same creative discussions. And, you know, people have not loved everything we've done. You know, there's been DLCs and balance complaints, and, you know, there's always, you know, some kind of level of, you know, there's one part of the game or something that we've done that is attracting some amount of negative attention. So I expect that to continue. And you know, I said it on the QA, if we release a DLC and you don't like it, it's not behavior's fault. It's because you don't like something we did, because we're still the ones making it. It's the same authors, the same team, kind of thing. So
yeah, that can lead into, I'm sure you've had so many questions with the behavior thing. I have just three questions about it. You can just answer yes or no, because you've probably heard them so much. Just three quick ones.
Easy.
It's just three simple ones. It's probably the ones that you hear the most, and it's just, will you maintain full control of the Darkest Dungeon IP?
Red Hook is, and I'm pausing because I want to be careful about how I answer. Because it isn't actually as simple as yes or no. You know, they have acquired us. They have acquired the IP. They don't want to ruin a good thing, and we have been a profitable business running and controlling the IP as we have for 10 years. So, with every conversation we've had with them, and the right down to the legal structure of the deal, we are as empowered as you can be in this arrangement to continue to be the stewards of the IP and to continue to run our studio the way we see fit. Tyler and I, that is.
That, because I listened to the Q&A, so I kind of know some of these answers already. Like, sure. This next one, it should be, this one I think is more easy because you have a lot of pride in your work, and I respect this. And it's, should people expect a collaboration with, of course, Dead by Daylight?
No, they shouldn't. Thank you. The DBD pipeline is packed. You know, they have their own schedule, and they've been working on it for years and years and years and years. They've got their own development priorities. And we don't let anything into Darkest Dungeon.
Yeah, so, I love that.
You know, we've done some things where, you know, a Darkest Dungeon character can appear over here, some other little indie collabs, you know, nothing really impactful. You know, like seismically impactful. Certainly fun little things to do, but we've never let anything into Darkest Dungeon. And that is, I think, very, very important to the integrity of the IP. Some IPs work well with fourth wall breaking nods to the audience. That's Deadpool's entire business model, and that's been going great as far as I can tell. But for Darkest Dungeon, I think it's so overwrought and hyperbolic and into itself that I think it starts to break down the more kind of silliness, that kind of, you know, cross-contamination that happens. One of my personal biggest pet peeves is like seasonal costumes in Overwatch, because when I first got into Overwatch, I loved that it was almost like G.I. Joe. Like, I grew up playing with like little G.I. Joe guys. And I was like, oh my God, this is just like a fresh take. There's an evil organization and they've got their sort of hero units, and there's a good guy organization, and the world geopolitics don't really make any sense, but sure, bad guy, good guy. I love it. And then it's like, well, Mercy can dress up as a witch, and Reaper has a pumpkin head because it's Halloween. And I'm like, but it's not Halloween for them, you know, yeah, just because it's Halloween for me now. I don't understand why they're dressing up in wacky costumes to have these, with this epic score and this presumptive battle between good and evil, that they're going to cosplay in their own world as they do it. It drives me absolutely crazy, and I refuse to do anything close to that for Darkest Dungeon. So there's no Santa hats coming into the game, and there's no Dead by Daylight characters coming in into the game.
That's good. I am also not a big fan of how much content gets added to those live service games, because it's just skin after skin after skin. And some of them look pretty cool, but it's like, they're also really expensive.
I mean, I think Helldivers has done an awesome job of having hundreds of skins. There's so many different, like, cool, like, legit in-world, like, kind of lore-grounded armors that you can either get for whatever premium currency, or you can, you know, accrue it in-game by playing, or however you get there. And they all look like they belong together and they're compatible with the world. So I'm all for, like, a million skins, but they all have to match and feel like the world is immersive and grounded in its own set of rules. I think that's what's really important to me.
Yeah, when I look at a live service game, I do feel like Helldivers does it kind of perfectly. Like, it costs money to play, but if you just buy the Battle Pass once, there's like no fear of missing out or anything. And like you said, everything fits in the game also just stays fun. So yeah, I agree with that. Helldivers is incredible.
Yeah.
Now, one last question for behavior before I got some questions about your art style, because your art style is quite legendary now, you'd say. This is just simple. I think this is a yes. And is this very good for Red Hook Studios, the acquisition?
Yes. Yeah, it is. We were not running a loss. Like, we did not have to sell the company. We're not out looking to sell it. We had a vision for what we want to do next. And we're not a studio. Well, Tyler and I are not the type of people who like to tread the same ground creatively over and over again. All the Darkest Dungeon 1 DLCs were different from each other. Darkest Dungeon 2 is different from Darkest Dungeon 1. We need to have fun making it. We need to feel challenged making it in order for us to feel like it's really a worthwhile endeavor. Because, you know, a game takes 5 years of your life, right? So you don't have limitless games in you to make. And so I don't want to spend the next half a decade doing the same thing I just did for half a decade, if I can avoid it at all. So we like the challenge. And we cooked up a plan for something that we wanted to do. And, you know, in discussions with behavior, they were extremely excited about that plan. And we started thinking, you know, this could be a really great partnership, a really great opportunity for us to take a bigger swing, grow Darkest Dungeon in a way that we can't do at the scale that we're operating. And secure funding for the next 3 to 5 years for our team and pursue this kind of vision that we had. You can be profitable, but without a bigger economic force behind you, you are limited in what you can do. So we can continue on as we were, but I mentioned this in the QA as well. There is risk to every path. And, you know, the number of risks facing us as purely independent, I think exceeded the number of risks that face us as part of the behavior family. And we certainly spoke candidly with them about all of this as we kind of worked through the deal process, because our independence is something that we're very proud of. You know, it's something that we fought really hard and we earned it kind of day in, day out over years. And the fact that we were able to kind of thread the economic needle of the past couple of years and survive that and not be in an existential crisis at the moment of sale was something that I personally am, like, quietly quite proud of. But this made a lot of sense given where we wanted to take the company. It made a lot of sense for stability for our employees and our team. And so I think it's just the most right course of action for where we are and where the market is right now. So I'm really happy with it. And it's been a lot going through the whole process. I've never done it before. I've never built a business and then sold it. But I think on the other side of all this work is going to be some really, really exciting stuff. And I think the community is going to freak out when we get there.
Oh, I'm excited to take it there. But first, we should probably take it back to where it all began. And I like to think that the Darkest Dungeon art style, it's one of my favorite personally. I love the game, as you probably are well aware, because the people were selling me out on Twitter when I added you. But where did you get this art style? Like, was the vision clear right out the gate when you started work on Darkest Dungeon 1 on what you wanted to do?
Artistically, I've always been a bit of a chameleon. Working on so many different types of games, you realize that like adaptation is a very important trait to have as a working commercial concept artist or art director. I taught a bunch of character design classes, and I would always meet, there was always a group or two or three per class of young people who would declare that they were anime artists, like full stop. And I always take issue with that because I have no problem with anime, but it is a stylization of reality. Be an artist and then stylize as you see fit, but don't declare, because then what happens is that the style becomes like walls around you, and they limit your understanding of art because you're looking purely through this one lens. So I didn't draw like this normally. I grew up, you know, reading comics and drawing more like this than I had it for years. I got into digital painting. There was a lot of demand for the kind of big, chunky, colorful World of Warcraft style stuff for quite a while. Cell shading, stylizing stuff. I've worked on mobile games where the proportions and the colors have to be real punchy. So I've worked on like darker stuff. The Pirates of the Caribbean stuff was like, we had some pretty gruesome stuff in there. It looked really cool. More photo-y, realistic-y, kind of with like pushed proportions here and there. So I tried all these different things. But what mattered to me most when we started Darkest Dungeon was how do I express the values of the game artistically? And that felt like I approached it as an art director would. You know, where are we going to pull influences from? What do we want the art to say? And then I would teach myself to draw in a way that would, you know, reflect those influences and that, like, creative kind of thrust, if that makes sense. So I looked at a lot of, like, woodcuts. I looked at a lot of Mignola. I looked at a lot of Guy Davis, Bernie Wrightson even, you know, which he's amazing with the hacking, and I don't do a lot of that, but still the old kind of blocky, eerie comics, pulp horror type stuff, and tried to pull in a bunch of that into something that, you know, we could ultimately kind of make our own. And I think it's kind of evolved, obviously, like the more I've done it, I have a better sense of what it needs to look like now than maybe when I was first starting out. But I learned and taught myself to work this way in order to accomplish the broader creative goal.
That broader creative goal, I think, was most definitely accomplished in your eyes, because Darkest Dungeon's been out for, it started in early access, 9 years ago? It's been out for 8 years in 1.0. Mm-hmm. And you had this game on Kickstarter originally, and it raised over $300,000. And yep. How hard or fun was it to complete all those incentives you provided, like letting some backers help you design bosses or draw in their face? Was that a lot of fun, or was that a unique challenge?
I mean, it can be both. Is it easier for me to just put my head down and get it done and not have to worry about someone else's input? Probably. But I had a good time with the collaborative backer stuff, the collector. The Abomination Hero class was done in collaboration with our top tier backer, and they were all really great to work with. So I think like it could have been worse for sure. I've worked with clients that were challenging, but these guys were all fantastic. So that part of it was great. Fulfilling physical goods sucks, and I always recommend anyone who's doing a Kickstarter for a video game to be very, very aware that they're not in the consumer products business. They're in the video game business. So keychains and mugs and posters and all that stuff, none of that is fun to work on or to get fulfilled. It all sucks.
So you didn't like giving out, there was Darkest Dungeon socks available in Kickstarter?
No.
Was that just an example?
No, it's just an example. Yeah, we tried to avoid it, but we still had some physical goods. The art book was amazing, but it's a lot of work to collect, you know, all these random files across like gigabytes of a Dropbox and then decide which ones are going to go into the book. And then, oh, you don't have the right resolution. You don't want the book to have pixels in it, right? Because you drew it at screen res because it was 3 a.m. or whatever it is. So it was a long process to try and like get all that ironed out. Nothing is without cost.
Now you said saw a backer helped with the Abomination class, which I think is pretty cool. But do you have any, I think I know this answer, I think we share the same favorite, but do you have any favorite heroes in terms of design that were most fun for you to make?
I mean, I get this.
Yeah, that's probably
I get this a lot. One. It is really hard. It's kind of impossible. I like try to make really cool a really cool cast of characters. I think about them kind of as like low fantasy X-Men a little bit. They all have their costumes and their superpowers and their tragic origins. So there's a lot of like my, because I grew up reading superhero comics. There's a lot of that kind of DNA in a Darkest Dungeon character cast. I'm really happy with the Leper design. I'm happy with the Plague Doctor design. Happy with the Grave Robbers. I'm happy with a lot of that work. I think they're some pretty cool characters, quite frankly. Highwayman's my favorite, just because I like the Highwayman, Soldier 76, that archetype, you know?
Yeah.
The grizzled, whatever. I like it, and I'm slowly becoming it.
Yeah, I can see you pulling off a Soldier 76 cosplay.
You got getting there.
You got the grayscale perfectly for that.
Yeah, yeah. I think, and a big part too, though, is like visually, yeah, I'm pretty proud of those designs, but a lot of their eventual kind of uptake by the community came from some of the mechanical, like the skill-based stuff became really, you know, kind of an inextricable part of their identities as well. You know, the same way you could be like, well, do you like Cyclops's character design? Well, sure, but do you like that he shoots lasers out of his eyes? You know, I love that. So like skills like point blank shot for the Highwayman, or the big like leper chop, you know, or the Plague Doctor with the big toxic grenade, like their skills themselves kind of are part of their identity, I think, and people really resonate with that. The occultist, you know, calling down the ceiling spaghetti on people.
The ceiling spaghetti. I will say the designs of the characters are all great. The balancing for all the characters and all the different combinations you can do, was that a nightmare to try to balance it all well so you have like an even amount of people that are good in the back, good in the front, maybe good all
around? Yeah, I mean, it's a huge amount of work. That's definitely where, you know, on DD1, Tyler did all of that stuff. You know, we've had some help over the years, and certainly now we have a bigger design team on DD2. We have, you know, James and Eric and working along with us on those types of things. So I don't touch that stuff too much. I come up with, like, what their hook should be. In the case of the Bounty Hunter, the hook, literally. But I'm not an expert in math or balance, and arguably people are unhappy with the balance all the time anyway, so I feel bad for those guys because it's never in a sweet spot.
You get more of the praise because people are like, oh, the artwork is
incredible. It's so not fair.
People are like, oh, I hate the balance, though. I miss every single time. And it's just like,
yeah. Yeah. It's a little asymmetrical. I feel bad for Tyler sometimes in that regard. But there's no such thing as perfectly balanced, and you don't want it to be, because every hero then feels the same.
Yeah.
So we like things to be a little bit spikier, and you know, we're not afraid to go back and retune and change and adjust, like we've been doing, rolling updates to all of the DD2 hero paths, you know, over the course of this year. It's just because we have learned what we've learned. We've seen how people play with them, and we want to take another crack at like refining, adding some interest, some complexity, some nuance to them. So all that is fun to do.
I got a few more Darkest Dungeon 1 questions. I have like a billion, but I got a few more good ones before I can go into Darkest Dungeon 2, which that's another whole topic. But when you start a first new run of Darkest Dungeon, you start off with a Highwayman and a Crusader, and their names are Dismas and Renald, legendary names. What's the story behind every character having their own little unique name?
Well, I can't even take credit for that. Over the course of DD1's development, several of the small team that we had would toss out kind of ideas. And initially, there wasn't a whole lot of like creative oversight put on what those names were. It was just a default name. And we were thinking of the characters really as like archetypes or classes and not individuals. But, you know, they've kind of, those names have been associated inextricably with the characters now. And we've kind of moved to embrace that with DD2, where we explore them more as individuals as opposed to just like kind of a one size fits all class archetype. But yeah, that just kind of some of the names came from different team members just entering in a default and like, okay, yeah, that's good for now. We got it up and running, you know, and it just became what it is. I know that, yeah, Dismas is named after the penitent thief in the Bible, and, you know, Baldwin is named after the leper king from history. Reynald is also a historical reference from the Crusades. Paracelsus is a name of, I think, a female plague doctor from history. So there's a lot of, Boudica was a barbarian queen, which is the Hellion name. There was a lot of historical reference that went in there, and I think, you know, came from a few different people over the course of, you know, developing that game early on.
Now, do you have any thoughts on crazy challenges that people like to do in Darkest Dungeon 1, like a torchless blood moon run, something crazy like that?
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, it's amazing. People, yeah, I love it. What's not to love, right? People are just like, the level of mastery and the amount of hours you must have in the game to be able to attempt something like that is just like staggering. And it feels very humbling to know that somebody felt like that was a good use of their time. You know, that someone was like, I like it, I'm going to play it, I beat it, I'm going to beat it again, I'm going to beat it again harder, I'm going to strip away absolutely every advantage I could possibly have and try and beat it again. Like, that level of kind of investment and commitment is really like, is a big honor for us to see. So I'm always like kind of in awe and humbled when I see someone like either tag me or just, you know, post on the subreddit. You know, I tied my hands to my feet and played it on Stygian Torchless Blood Moon 9000, and I still managed to beat it in 3 weeks or whatever, you know, 3 game weeks. I'm like, how? But it's really cool.
Yeah, I've only...
Why we make games, right? It's why we do it.
It's, yeah, like, it's seeing
that kind of to get that kind of response from people is like the most validating thing. I want to make sure they're eating well. Yeah, I want to make sure they're eating well and they're getting exercise and they're doing all the things you need to do to be a human being. But you want to spend that kind of time in the game that we made, I welcome you.
Yeah, I can't even imagine doing it. Like, I was able to win one Blood Moon run, but even then, I still missed, like, fighting bosses and all of that. And I guess I could ask, obviously, balancing a boss is probably Tyler's specialty. But what about designing a boss? Do you have any fan favorite bosses out there? Or I guess bosses?
The way we start the process is always like creative first. So we'll talk about like, you know, like for the witch, I had a concept. I'm like, oh, and then they'll throw one of you in the pot. You know, isn't that cool? Old school throwback, you know, witch in the woods, boiling the kids, you know, Hansel and Gretel type stuff. And then we figure out mechanically how to make that work. But it always starts with like a really cool or exciting creative idea. So I think, you know, the witch is one of my favorite. I love the Swine King with the little guy who's like kind of just a misdirection. In DD2, I really love the Leviathan. I think that boss is like a high point for the studio, just in terms of the payoff, the visual presentation, the mechanic. The way it all comes together, I thought it was just incredible. And I love seeing people fight that boss for the first time because it's just like a floating head. And then, you know, the hand bursts up and you're like, oh shit, there's this whole other like mechanic that I have to juggle. And I really love, you know, that moment. And I love the final boss from DD1. I think it was a really cool choice to just force you to delete heroes that you've invested like hours in building up. I liked that mercilessness. In terms of a service to the theme and the story, I thought it made perfect sense. And although it flies in the face of like every single Gamma Sutra game developer article ever written about how to treat your players, we thought like, no, this is the right move for the game. You know, you're trying to defeat a god with a two-handed sword. Like, you're not going to be able to do it. It's insulting. He should punish you really harshly for trying. So yeah, I think any of the bosses we've done where there's a real strong mechanical hook really resonate well for me, because I feel like it is a representation of like both design and art, you know, synthesizing to deliver an experience that neither one could deliver alone.
Yeah, I noticed that every single boss, especially in Darkest Dungeon 2, first time you face them, you're like, oh, like with Wilbur and the Swine King, you just walk in and you're like, oh, I can kill this little guy immediately and just, then I'll focus the big guy. You kill the little guy and then all your characters are dead and you're like, oh, okay, well, I guess I shouldn't do that again.
Yeah, I like that learning by experience, you know, and by sacrifice. I think that's cool. And in DD2, it's like the first time you get to a confession boss at the end, you should expect to lose. Like, I want you to lose the first time you face it. Like, what is going on? What is this? That's kind of, we like to give our bosses little hooks and tricks and puzzles and try and outwit people at least the first time through. And I think it makes killing them even more satisfying.
Oh, 100%. I remember in my first playthrough of Darkest Dungeon 2, when it released out of early access, I was struggling so hard to kill that second boss in the second chapter. And then I finally did it, and I was like, oh, was the lungs. Those goddamn lungs fight. That is just, oh, they're all well designed, but oh my God.
A lot of people get stuck there. But it's an interesting like crossroads because you don't have a whole lot unlocked yet in the game. That boss is a bit of a gate, like it's a bit of a check for not only how well can you survive the run up to it, but you know how far along are your characters? Have you upgraded their death blow resistance? All of this kind of thing. So it's like kind of once you get through the lungs, you're kind of playing it for real at that point. So that that boss should be hard. It should be a
I remember when the second game actually came out, the third boss, I saw a lot of negative feedback on the eyeball boss because of how hard it was. Did you expect that to happen with, like, you know, the third boss instead of, like, the final boss?
I'm glad it happened with the third boss instead of the final boss. The eyeball thing was, like, it started out as more of a puzzle. Like, we wanted a puzzle boss. And it just took a few go-arounds to get it in a good spot. It's just the nature of the craft. Iteration is really important. And the idea that, you know, you can get something, especially like we're in early access at this point, right? So iteration should be assumed to be the order of the day. But it's really hard to get something just immediately perfect right out of the gate in any profession, anywhere, at any time in human history. And so the eyeball boss, you know, started out as a little bit more of a puzzle. We tried it one way. We didn't like it. We tried it another way. We didn't like it. We got something we thought would work. We shipped it. It wasn't working the way we wanted. People weren't having the experience we wanted. So, I mean, we just kept going back to the well, and poor Eric, the designer on it, you know, he didn't give up. He's just, okay, we'll try this. Well, we had a bunch of, kind of sessions internally, playtesting, looking at feedback, and just kept kind of working it over, reimagining it, challenging our assumptions, and ultimately got it to a good spot. So, I mean, the negative feedback is fine. It's part of what we do. It's part of what we have to kind of sift through, because sometimes, you know, it's kind of undeniable, like where there's smoke, there's fire. So if there's a bunch of negative feedback around something, something in there isn't working. We stop short of doing like the solutions proposed by fans are often not appropriate for us to pursue because they aren't mindful of broader or bigger issues in terms of like resource allocation, cost, timeliness, competing priorities. Like they just don't have this information. But when there is a bunch of smoke or negativity around a certain thing, it's obvious it's not working. And it's our responsibility to go in, work through all of those comments, try to understand and get to the root of why something is unsatisfactory, and then address it in a way that makes sense for where we're at, you know, on our own timelines, you know, budget, that kind of stuff. So we engage in that process really earnestly. You know, we're not afraid of reading that somebody doesn't like something. It's like I said, it's been 10 years. There's been a lot of situations where people haven't liked what we've done, and we've worked through it. So that's just part of the job.
Yeah, I know a lot of people say Darkest Dungeon's too hard for me, all of that stuff, too much RNG, but I honestly think that's part of the charm. Having all that challenge and randomness, and I think it's great. But you did mention the budget, and I remember in the Q&A you said Darkest Dungeon 2 cost $15 million to make, which I think some people will be like surprised because they don't actually understand how expensive it is to make a game. Did you expect it to cost that much, or just over time it happened because it was a long game to make?
You can't run a business and not anticipate costs. You can't just say, whoops.
Whoopsie daisies.
how did we get here? You know, so we were aware of what kind of a size of a game it would be in the team size that we would need to execute on it. That's not that expensive for what games typically cost. In fact, I think Darkest Dungeon 2 presents as having a much higher budget than it did. I think that we did an exceptional job as a studio of punching above our weight class. We were, you know, whenever we're put up next to other indie games, I think we don't look indie. I think we look too polished. You know, we're aspiring to a different standard, it feels like sometimes. And I don't say that derisively against other indie games, but there is a vibe that goes with those games that I don't think that we... have adopted. But conversely, if you put us up against EA's latest blockbuster, no, there's no way we can compete. So we kind of exist in this like liminal space where despite having a very, you know, responsible and constrained budget, we swagger like we've spent more than we did. But as a result, we kind of sit in a weird spot, I think, in the industry when you start chunking it out in economic terms.
Oh, yeah, because then all these other indie games will be like, oh, but my budget's $10. And it's just like, well, you're going to have fun. So,
I mean, you can only do what you can do.
Yeah, you do what you can do.
Part of it is like when you do game development, you know, when we started Darkest Dungeon 1, we didn't have any budget. We had, I had 24 grand saved up, and that had to last me until we brought it to market. Obviously, it wouldn't. You know, I had a family of four, including me. Kickstarter helped a little bit, but it was really scary, and we were going like basically like running out of money to kind of get there. But even then, we were trying to look to ways to appear more polished than what we had spent on it. So I guess maybe there's a cultural thing in our studio about that.
I mean, you strive for perfection. I guess I could ask also, how hard was it to transition? Like, because the first game, it's just walking in the hallways, the beautiful 2D art. But the second game, you have these crazy animations and 3D models. How hard of a transition was that?
Really hard. Really hard. It took a year to just build combat in 3D. It took longer to build it in 3D than it did to build it the first time in 2D for Darkest Dungeon 1. Never mind changing it to a token-based thing, like all those design things, which were great successes. Just the presentation, just to match the presentation of the 2D game, took longer than before, just because the complexity of 3D characters, assets, textures, rigs, animations, cameras. Once you're in a 3D camera, you know, things, there are rules and limitations in terms of what you can do. Rendering, transparency, Zed fighting, like tons and tons of issues to just like work through to get it up to par. But if you go back and you compare DD1 to DD2, like it's miles apart in terms of what DD2 combat looks like and feels like. It's a massive step forward over DD1. And I love DD1, you know. But that was an example of like, we need to be smart. We can't do everything. So what can we do really, really well? Well, we can draw really, really well, but we can't animate really, really well because we don't have a team of animators to animate every single move with big follow through. So what if we just skip frames? What if we just focus on the impact, cut away everything that we don't need to do, be super, super economical and spend all of our resources on these key moments? Could we make that work? And we did. And when we went to move to 3D, we even tried adding like slow motion to the zoom ins because we thought, okay, you know, this will like really help amp it up. But it actually made it feel soupy and kind of sluggish. And so we went back to that real economical like cut to the frame and focus only on recoveries. But the amazing thing about 3D is that it allows you to hit a much higher polish ceiling. The effects are like worlds better in DD2. The animation is miles beyond what we were doing in DD1, and we sell so much more of the character's personality with all of those like anticipatory flourishes, recovery, that kind of thing. It just brings so much more life to the game than did DD1 had. Although I will always love Darkest Dungeon 1 because I labored over every single one of those fights.
Yeah, I love Darkest Dungeon 2. That was like the biggest surprise for me from 1 to 2 was how clean everything did look, because it was the first time you guys did 3D. And all the different lore that you added with hero confessions and the stories and the characters back and forth, backstabbing each other, getting into relationships in the run, which my community was like, oh shoot, everybody's, you know. But Darkest Dungeon 2, it got announced in 2019 that it was in the works. Did the pandemic affect the development time at all?
I mean, almost certainly, but I don't think we were as impacted as maybe some other studios. I think our team did a pretty good job of migrating to work from home. The original group of us who had done DD1 did big long stints at home. We didn't have an office. We didn't want to incur the overhead of having to pay for a space. So we went for months and months working just remotely, separately. So there was no real impact to me personally. I'd kind of been through that. I'd also been a freelancer and worked from home. So like working from home was nothing new or special to me. I knew that you need a routine. You need to have a shower. You need to take a walk in the morning before you sit down to work. And so it didn't hit me that hard at all. I think the team overall did great. I know some bigger organizations really struggled with communication, logistics as part of everybody being distributed. But I think that, you know, we have about 30% of our team is already distributed. So we work in Slack, and I think, you know, it just didn't impact us quite as much. I don't think we lost too much velocity, you know. Certainly there was an impact, but I don't think it was like we would have been out a year sooner if it hadn't been for the pandemic or anything like that.
It's always interesting to hear the different sides because there's so many logistics that go into game making, but it's nice to know that you guys work from home just fine. Now, I want to talk about the Crusader in Darkest Dungeon 2. I'm going all over the place. I got so many questions and only so much time. He has... Like, in Darkest Dungeon 1, you just get a character from the stagecoach, and you pick them up. Darkest Dungeon 2, you unlock them with meta progression, which, by the way, love the meta progression. But the Crusader has a more unique unlock method. And for future new characters or returning characters, do you want to have that level of uniqueness to unlock them, like, with a fun little quest inside of a run?
No. It's not a new standard, you know. Again, like we like to try stuff. I think we weren't gonna bring the Crusader back. I had put his helmet in a few places as kind of like a nod to like the fact that he was around. But partway through early access, we're like, you know, people really, really like this character, and although he's pretty conventional in terms of his design, there was this something about him being, you know, one of the two first characters that you get in DD1 that the community was really hungry for. So we said, okay, well, get the game out. If it sells well, we'll do a DLC. We'll put the Crusader in. And so to kind of, I don't know, reward is the wrong word, but to celebrate his return and the fact that a lot of people in the community were really vocal about wanting to have this character, we wanted to kind of give him like a grand reintroduction. And I think that it also played well in terms of the DLC as a package. So if you think about it, we're going to sell you two characters, right? If you just load up to the crossroads and they're both there, you're going to play a couple of runs. You're going to get their skills. You're going to be like, okay, cool. You know, I put both the Duelist and the Crusader in my party. I consume them both at the same time, and I'm fatigued with both of them at the same time. So doing the quest, what it allowed us to do is say, hey, meet the Duelist, learn about this new character's skills, unlock her hero shrines as you pursue the unlock for the Crusader. Now that you have some familiarity with the Duelist, you've completed the Crusader quest, and now you have the Crusader. And so now take him out, do his shrines. And it kind of, it meters out the content in a little bit of a more favorable way. I think it's a little bit more digestible than just being hit over the head with two complicated characters, boom, right out of the gate. So it helped with the DLC pacing, but it was primarily driven by a genuine desire on our part to sort of thank the community for their like constant support for the character and to sort of like celebrate and, you know, grand fashion the return of this guy. But it's not going to be like a standard that we do for every new hero, you know, as we go. We look at each DLC as like a different product and look for adding value in different ways. So for instance, the upcoming DLC in Human Bondage has a new playable character in it. The scope of that character is such that an additional quest on top of it would have been hard to justify. And it's shipping with another region with monsters and trinkets and loot and new mechanic and all this other stuff. So there's a ton of value already there. And layering another quest in there as part of it feels like it would be kind of overkill, but also like it would rob from the like mythology around the Crusader that we built up in that quest. I like that he has a quest the same way I like that the Bounty Hunter is not fully playable in the confession mode. It just kind of creates some spikiness. And I know that there's some friction around that particular decision in the community. And in Kingdoms, the Bounty Hunter will be playable as a regular character. But as it relates to the run-based game, we felt like it's neat. Less of him is more. I didn't need as much Boba Fett as Disney gave me in the end. I liked Boba Fett the less I knew about him. And Stuart's trying to evoke that a little bit, you know?
That's actually a very good analogy for it. Doesn't Boba Fett have all these like TV shows now too? I don't pay too much attention to Star Wars, but it was fun just because he was a guy that was there for like two movies, 20
And you're like,
total.
He must be a badass because he has nothing to say and he's all acting. And, you know, the more you learn, the more they over-explain. The mythology kind of gets eroded. So Boba Fett Batman was kind of the inspiration for the Bounty Hunter. And we thought it would be cool to keep him secret. He doesn't have an origin that you can know for certain. He's
a bounty hunter.
Yeah.
He's not going to tell you about his story.
Yeah, exactly. Now we may change our minds in the future and unpack that a little bit, but I'm just bringing it as an example of like that mechanic suited that character in that game mode. The Crusader origin quest suited the Crusader for his reintroduction to the franchise, but shouldn't be taken as a sort of template that we're going to just run a quest for every new character every time now.
Now you mentioned that, so you have the Kingdoms, the free update. Kingdoms is the free update, right? And then you have a paid DLC coming with it. And there's a new character. This isn't like a returning character, because I know everyone's asking like Houndmaster, Abomination, everyone's asking for everybody. But this is like a whole new character coming with the paid DLC?
No.
Oh, they're going to be free with Kingdoms?
It's a returning character.
Oh, it's a returning character.
In the paid DLC. Kingdoms does not... We're not bringing a new playable hero to the game for free as part of Kingdoms. But Kingdoms is bringing a new like faction of enemies, a whole game mode. Like, it's a complete remix album.
Yeah, it looked like a city builder type thing, but you have to like just defend the city, and it looked very nice.
You move from inn to inn. So you get in your stagecoach, you drive. The regions are much, much shorter. So you'll drive from through regions to different inns. You'll upgrade them. They have like upgrade paths. They get attacked and sieged by the new faction. You have to kind of move around the map defending them and working to complete a quest chain to discover the location of the boss before, you know, kind of time runs out type thing. So there's a bit of pressure, but you are free to kind of roam around. You get like a group of heroes. Quirk management becomes more important now because you're seeing the same characters and you can drop them off at inns and pick them up later and that kind of thing. So it's a whole different way of playing DD2. It's not like a run-based in the same way that the Confessions mode is. But it introduces a fair amount of new content all for free.
Now, is that still planned for 2024?
Yeah, if you can say. Yeah, we're working like hell on it. It's one of those things, though. It has to be good. We want it to be good. We don't want to bring it out just to say we got it out, and have it kind of be lackluster or not deliver on its promise. So job number one is to make sure that it's good.
I can imagine that's hard. So I know we're running short on time here, so I don't want to take you too much. I guess this will be an off-topic question, kind of related to Darkest Dungeon, but not really. But when you first showcased Kingdoms, it was back in April during the Triple I initiative. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask, like, how did that become a thing? Because it was a giant, I guess, conglomerate of indie studios, kind of, I guess you could say, the big ones. How did Red Hook get involved with that? And I guess who kind of started that? Because it was a very well-made showcase.
Yeah, it was great. Evil Empire out of France had the idea and put it together. And they've done a bunch of interviews. We did a bunch of interviews at GDC with them. But it was their brainchild. They wanted to announce their game. And they thought, you know, there's no real space for us to be able to do this. What if we made our own, you know, PlayStation-esque showcase? And so I think that's where the idea kind of incepted from. And they reached out to us. They reached out to a bunch of indie studios of kind of similar scale, similar ambition, and put together the whole thing. And so we were like, look, it's really early for us to be showing Kingdoms, quite frankly. Really early. But we wanted to push and get something together, because we felt like the idea was great. You know, we were committed internally to that development track, so it's not like we're going to change our minds suddenly. But I wish that it had been 6 months later so we could show more or have what we had shown, you know, be a little bit more developed. But it was important to us to support our colleagues, because we think the initiative is just a great idea. Be happy to support it again if they do it again next year in whatever capacity we can.
I was going to ask if you know if there's another one, but there's a lot of showcases coming up. But
I don't know. Yeah, I agree. I'm not sure if they're going to do it again. It was very successful, so I'd be surprised if they didn't. You know, post-acquisition, maybe they don't want us in there, but I'll still find a way to kind of support it, because I think what they're doing is really great. I think it's a cool idea, and took a lot of guts to execute on that and follow through like they did. So I have a lot of respect for that group.
Yeah, I also noticed that Wayne June was the one saying world premiere. Did you set them up with Wayne June?
Yeah, well, I wrote a couple of lines for him to say, and then they're like, okay, well, let us know what we owe you, and I was like, we'll pay for it, but I want a custom line for the Kingdoms before our trailer goes. I want a special line. I said okay, so we did it that way.
Yeah, people love Wayne June. That's definitely another one of those big things, and there's a lot of small things in Darkest Dungeon that just are so memorable. With Wayne June's voice acting being the narrator, the art style, the stress system, all the different DOTs, the corpses. There's not even a question there. It's just loving the game. That's all I can say.
That's great to hear. It's a dense game for sure. And it's, you know, maybe to circle back a little bit, like the same kind of group of people who made those choices and crafted those games is still here, and it was our plan that got Behavior really excited about what we want to do next. So I'm hopeful that over time people will have their fears assuaged by seeing the continual kind of stream of stuff that we cook up and ship.
I imagine they will, because people forget all that stuff. They'll forget even that Behavior even owns Red Hook, because it'll be nothing will change. It'll feel like.
Yeah, that's the goal. That's kind of been the framework for all of our discussions with them, is that we just keep doing what we're doing, except we do it with a little bit. We have more people, we have more resources, we can support DD2 longer, and we can aspire to this kind of bigger project that we want to do.
And that's kind of everything, because I know you are on a time limit right now. So I'll have one more question for you, just one more.
For sure. Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Do you have any questions for me, the consumer, and the gamer that plays your games?
what is the most frustrating and not in a good way experience that you've had
in Darkest Dungeon?
One or two. Yeah. Ooh, like, has there ever been a situation where you're like, you know what? Like, fuck this game.
I think when Darkest Dungeon 2 first came out, I was a little hesitant on the token system because I had so much time with Darkest Dungeon 1. I was used to just stuns and blood and blight. The token system at first, I was very confused with a few of them, mostly with like the vessel and the, what was it? What's that? It's like that angel token that you stack up over time.
Yeah, the consecration.
Those tokens kind of frustrated me when I first got into the game. But then, you know, I played it for 100 hours and it didn't take me 100 hours to learn it. But as time went on, I was just like, okay, wait a minute. Now I have two of these, so I'm going to do more damage or I'm going to heal more and all of that. So the token system was the biggest, like, because obviously I got absolutely fucked by some bosses here and there, but it's like, okay, it's Darkest Dungeon. It's going to be hard.
I feel like we're pretty clear that that's going to happen. Yeah.
Because like a warning pops up when you play. It's like, yeah, you're going to get fucked.
Yeah, that's kind of our whole thing.
Yeah, but it was just the tokens. That's it. And even now, if I load up Darkest Dungeon 2, I'll get it in like 5 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, you get used to it. I think the token system was actually an improvement, but definitely a difference.
A huge difference, but I also agree. Improvement. It's a nice change of pace. That's something I like and respect with Darkest Dungeon 2. You changed it up, but still kept like the formula at its core. Kind of the same lovable characters, same lovable designs, but new game. And it's just not the same thing, and that makes it a lot of fun for me.
Yeah, I think the IP or the world gets enriched when you see it through different vantage points, right? Like, there's a million different Batman stories that have been told, a million different versions, Gaslight, future Batman, year one, year 50, Dark Knight Returns, there's a million ways to look at the idea of Batman. And I think when I think about our IP, obviously we're nowhere near that. But that the game can change and the tone and the heroes and the world can be consistent throughout and just looked at it from a different perspective, I think strengthens what we've done. It doesn't weaken it at all.
Yeah, it's a beautiful game, and I'm excited for the Kingdoms DLC. I'll say that, the paid DLC and the free update, which is going to have a lot of content. I'm super excited. So I guess closing thoughts, if you want to sell anything out, tell anything to the people listening or watching, you can. But I appreciate you taking some time out of your day to join me on this little podcast.
No, of course. I appreciate the chance to chat. I think for us, I just want to tell people that, you know, I personally will go through and read everything on Reddit. We keep up to date on our Discord. We're active and we're listening and we're hoping that that you enjoy what we've got in store for you.
That's it. Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of Interviewing Indies, the biggest indie we've had on here for sure. Thanks again, Chris, and we'll see you all next time. Thanks for listening or watching this episode of Interviewing Indies. It was an absolute pleasure to be able to sit down and talk with the developer of one of my favorite games of all time, so special thanks again to Chris for coming on to the show. If you're an indie developer and you want to get on the show, message me on Twitter or email me, and we can work something out. And if you want to get the shows early, be sure to subscribe to the Patreon. Thanks again for listening and watching, and we'll see you next time.